From Miami Beach, Florida, welcome to Believe. I'm Nicholas Upchurch. Our website is www.believe.love. Our YouTube is youtube.com/believeloves you. iTunes listeners, you can download our show at believeiTunes.com and on Android at believeAndroid.com. It's an honor to be with you, and I am so excited because I want to help you to succeed and help you to find your truth and help you to believe in yourself. We have an amazing guest on our show today. Our guest is going to help to fill in some blanks of what is going on in terms of the movies and maybe some secret society stuff. And it's really exciting because our guest has such a prestigious background. He's really an amazing guy, and he has so much knowledge. You ever wonder when you see a movie if you're actually seeing some things? You know, maybe even they're kind of slipping things in there. They're slipping in bits of truth. Actually, we went over this on a previous episode recently about the new Star Wars and the trailer. And we were asking, Natalia and I were on the show, and we were asking, man, I wonder if there's some truth in that. And then we pulled up the moon, I think, around Jupiter or Saturn that looks like the Death Star. And we're like, man, did George Lucas know something? So our guest today is going to help us to fill in some blanks because we want to help you to be aware of what's going on. If you're aware, you can have success in business. You can feel happier. You can get maybe a fuller, a bigger idea or a bigger picture in terms of why you're here. So I want to introduce in a second Robert W. Sullivan IV. Rob is a philosopher, a historian. He's a lawyer, a mystic, a showman, a radio TV personality. You've heard him on Coast to Coast AM on the great Sean Stone show, which is called Buzzsaw. And Gaia, I love that show, actually. I watch that show a lot. He's been on Fade to Black with Jimmy Church. Love that show. And a variety of other, Veritas Radio. Love that. There's so many great places you've heard Rob on. He's the author of some really cool books. We're going to put those on screen now. And I recommend you check these out at Amazon. Specifically, as you can see here, the second edition of Cinema Symbolism, A Guide to Esoteric Imagery in Popular Movies. Also, The Royal Ark of Enoch. Arch, maybe? I don't know. I just got off a flight overnight from Vegas. I'm actually still waking up. We'll ask Rob in a second the proper title there, the proper pronunciation. I'm still like sleeping. I'm waking up. The Impact of Masonic Ritual. I know what that is, but Rob knows much more. The Impact of Masonic Ritual, Philosophy and Symbolism. The second edition is the one you need to pick up. And then Cinema Symbolism 2, More Esoteric Imagery in Popular Movies. I recommend you pick up all three. And Rob also studied at Oxford. He was a Oxford University, of course, a prestigious university. He was a member of the Oxford University Conservative Association and the Oxford Law Society. He's got a lot of amazing knowledge. I want to welcome to the show Rob Sullivan. Welcome, Rob.
Hey, thanks for having me on your show tonight. Believe, it's my pleasure to be here, and I look forward to the show. And thank you for the invitation. Much appreciated.
Well, thanks for being on. So, Rob, I would love to know, really, I'd like to get inside of your head. What is the most sort of groundbreaking thing that you've noticed about what's in the movies?
Oh, I think generally, I think it's two-pronged. The answer would be the material is actually in there, that this esoteric imagery is in the film. And it's one of those things that you don't have to really speculate on. You can watch the movie, and if you read the book, you'll be able to see it with your own eyes. So that's very interesting. It's not necessarily subject to speculation. You can actually see it. If you read the book or you've listened to some of my other shows and podcasts or radio shows, and certainly this one, you can actually find the material. You read the material and then see it in the film. And the other thing that's very fascinating is the absolute lengths these filmmakers will go to incorporate this imagery in films. In some instances, it's quite astounding. And it almost brings up the question of, in some instances that they actually, were more preoccupied with incorporating this imagery than actually making the movie. It's very interesting. And like I said, it's a fascinating subject because you can actually read the book and then watch the movie and see it with your own eyes.
So in terms of your most recent book, as you're mentioning, Cinema Symbolism 2, which again, I recommend everybody pick up on Amazon. What would you say that some of the most recent sort of, okay, so first of all, if we're just going to really simplify things, when you say esoteric symbolism, what should people be looking for? Because even if we're wanting to identify kind of what that means, can we talk about that? That'd be great.
Yeah, well, that's a real broad subject matter, and it really, there's no one answer for it. It depends on the film, because each film incorporates it or includes it in a different way. And I should also point out that some films don't include it at all. And not by not including it, it doesn't necessarily make it a poor movie. You can be dealing with a theme of a movie that is multi-layered or is a story within a story or it has esoteric underpinnings. You can be dealing with archetypal imagery. This can be embodied in the characters themselves. You could actually be dealing with symbols in the background of a film, dates, numbers. It can be dealing with archetypes. It can be dealing with storylines, the monomyth, the hero's journey. It can involve secret societies, ancient religions, Gnosticism, Kabbalah, alchemy. It's a sweeping subject matter, and no two films is alike. Each film that incorporates it can incorporate it, place it in a film in a different way. So I would say there's no like sweeping overall, definition. Thing going on. Each film has to be looked at individually on a case-by-case basis to see if this imagery is even present. And if it is, what kind of film is it? Is it alchemical? Is it Kabbalistic? Is it archetype? Is it the monomyth? Once that can be discerned, then the interpretation— Yeah, the symbolic interpretation then becomes much more clear, at least for me.
So we have some business. You know, we kind of have a mix. People watching this show, people that are trying to grow their business, trying to get healthy. And we also cover our universe and world news. So if somebody's just not even aware of occultism or esoteric imagery, like those words, they're actually getting started with those words. Or even when you're talking about alchemy, could you give us some examples of kind of what that might be like in some specific films? And I've seen you've mentioned Stanley Kubrick's films and in your book, Cinema Symbolism 2. But maybe just simplify some of what these terms mean, if you don't mind.
Sure. Well, like the hero's journey, the monomyth, this comes out of the world of Joseph Campbell. And this is the hero's journey, the monomyth. And this is an adventure. The hero, usually personifying a solar archetype, goes on some, grandiose quest to overthrow evil in some form or fashion. And on this quest, certain interactions and things happen to this character that are universal. They repeat. So when we're dealing with films like this, we're dealing with the Harry Potter films. We're dealing with the Star Wars films, specifically 4, 5, and 6. We're dealing with movies such as The Lord of the Rings. We're dealing with the Matrix trilogy. These would be all films that incorporate the monomyth. Alchemy, of course, medieval and Renaissance alchemy is the transmutation of base metal into gold. Symbolically, this is ignorance into wisdom. In film, this usually involves transition of the self, where the person begins as one thing and ends as something else. And it's usually negative. These alchemical transitions are very seldom positive. So you think of something like Black Swan, where the movie begins as she's a timid ballerina, and then she actually, through a transition, morphs into an actual Black Swan creature. That would be an alchemical film. Same with The Shining by Kubrick. This is a movie that where the guy starts as sort of a failed writer and morphs into a serial killer, a mass murderer. This would be characters who undergo an alchemical transition. An actual alchemical movie where you will actually see the transmutation of base metal into gold or the transmutation of metal would be Goldfinger by, the James Bond, where Goldfinger, the alchemist, is trying to transmute the gold in Fort Knox to make it worthless, to make his gold supply worth more money. So that is actual on-screen alchemy, quite literally. Wow. Then you have movies that involve Gnosticism, where it's a journey of enlightenment. Things that echo that theme would be, again, the Matrix movie, especially the first one. We would be dealing with something like The Wizard of Oz, Alice in Wonderland, the movie The Lovely Bones. It involves, the quest for self, to know thyself. This is another incredible incredible. Gnosticism is incredibly popular ancient religion that is very popular in Hollywood. It's a broad sweeping subject, and you know, no two films are really the same. It's each movie has to be looked at, and then it really what is key for me is to determine the film's context. When that is discovered, what I can determine its esoteric context, then the symbolism, at least for me, becomes much more readily apparent.
And what is your definition of esoteric? Because that's actually a really cool word, but I know a lot of people watching this aren't even really familiar with that word. And then, do you believe that there is truth disclosed in some of these movies with all of the symbolism?
Yes. Esoteric. What we're dealing with is mystical, hidden, occult symbolism that is used to convey ulterior or alternative, definitions of the movie, I guess is what I'm trying to say. You could watch a movie such as The Wizard of Oz. Let's take that. That's a great example. And you could just watch it on its face and say, okay, well, it's a journey of, you know, it's just an adventure of this girl getting swept to this magical land and having this adventure. And then she goes home at the end, have a nice day. That movie is very multi-layered. You have themes going on of initiation into selfhood, initiation into gnosis, very, very interesting themes regarding ancient religion, Gnosticism. You have an entire political allegory going on inside The Wizard of Oz. So this is a very multi-layered movie. When I say esoteric, it's hidden. It's not something that's going to jump off the screen at you. In some cases, it might. For me, it certainly does after I've been studying this for 20 years. But it's hidden in the celluloid is what I mean by when I use the word esoteric. And sure, there can absolutely be truths in it. There can be deeper meanings, deeper symbolism. We could be dealing with studies of comparative religion, archetypes that, the viewer may not be readily cognizant of, but through this imagery, it's really, harping on their subconscious mind, tweaking the archetypal imagery that we all have in our subconscious, really playing off of that. And it can be very powerful. And these filmmakers know very much what they're doing with it. I wouldn't go so far as to say it's a form of mind control or even so far as to say it's anything evil or anything like that. But it's definitely, when you're dealing with archetypal imagery, psychology, these themes, it's very powerful, and certainly movies are a very, very powerful tool, probably arguably the most powerful medium ever created. So this imagery is in there, and these filmmakers are using it, and it can be very potent. I think this is pretty, irrefutable.
I agree with you. So I love your definitions, and I want to further explore them because to clarify for people that are new to this, some other shows, Coast to Coast or Fade to Black, people may listen to that all the time and kind of know what archetypal means. But when you're like, when you say archetypal imagery, what would somebody be looking for in terms of what that might mean? And why is that important as well? Are they disclosing something? You know, we've heard like the Illuminati they feel that maybe they have to disclose things and shows and things like that to kind of get people's consent. But I guess there's a two-part question. The first is, what is archetypal imagery? Like, what's the definition of even an archetype? Some people may be new to that. And then also, like, are they trying to disclose things to kind of sort of get people's consent and sort of secretly let them know what they're doing in terms of maybe some sort of Illuminati or secret world organization or some of these secret societies?
Right. I'll answer the second question first. I don't believe in any of that at all.
Okay.
I don't buy into that. I think movies can be prophetic. Again, I would say in my books, I argue this is a mechanism of the collective unconscious. This is where the archetypes reside. Archetypal imagery, think the solar hero, the lunar heroine. You're dealing with a lot of astrological embodiments, planetary embodiments, Saturn, Jupiter, the Tarot, archetypes, the hero, the villain, the mother, the father, the lovers. These are the archetypes. Luke Skywalker, Neo, Frodo, these are all metaphoric stand-ins for the sun, the solar hero, the solar savior, the solar redeemer, the moon, the sacred feminine. These are the archetypes. I'm just giving you some examples. examples, and they can vary, and they can take on, you know, different meanings, and they can take on different imagery. But the archetypes are very powerful, and you know, this is what, you know, Carl Jung talked about in his work, and even Joseph Campbell talked about. You know, when we talk about with Campbell, like the hero's journey, the book he wrote is called The Hero of a Thousand Faces, with a thousand faces. Well, who's the hero he's talking about? It's the sun. It's always the solar hero, the solar avatar who's going on to deal with, to combat works of darkness. That's really the underlying theme with all this. You know, you can call it neo-Manichaeanism, I suppose. Light versus dark, good versus evil. I guess that's probably the oldest conflict of all. I mean, my goodness gracious, it's all over Hollywood films. I don't believe necessarily that there's some sort of secret global organization placing this stuff in films. That's pretty ridiculous, in my opinion. You know, I think some films are prophetic. I think some stuff is planted in there on purpose. I know that the government worked with the filmmakers of Transformers to put the railgun in, I think, the second Transformer movie. This is where they're announcing it, but this was no hidden secret. They came out and admitted this. Films can certainly be prophetic. I don't dispute that either. There are some very strange coincidences going on, and I say in the book, I don't believe in coincidences. As a lawyer, I don't buy into that. So, you know, how do you explain it? What I propose in my books is I get into the whole idea of Carl Jung and the collective unconscious and how this is inherited from generation to generation. And I suggest in the book that the collective unconscious, you know, unconsciousness may not necessarily only be inherited, but it may also be predictive. So what I conclude in the book is, and again, this is me speculating, this is not proven, is that, you know, when you get into a movie that may be prophetic, it could be the collective unconscious at work, actually working in reverse, since films are an artistic expression, ultimately, arguably one of the most powerful artistic expressions ever created. It would not surprise me at all that the collective unconscious could somehow integrate itself into a film as a prophetic mechanism. That's what I propose in the book, because clearly there are films that are prophetic. That I do not dispute.
So how do you know for sure that there's nothing hidden in films?
Oh, there is stuff hidden in films.
But I mean, how do you, okay, do you think there is, do you think the president is in charge of the United States?
Well, I think he's in charge of it with Congress and the Supreme Court.
Who's in charge of the NSA?
Well, I would think this would fall. I mean, this is a political,
right?
You know,
but right. Okay. Do you think there are any organizations that are working in addition to the governments on policy in the world today?
Well, you have groups like Bilderberger and
right.
Certainly the Trilateral Commission and things like that, but I don't necessarily see them, you know, working toe in toe with, you know, with Hollywood or anything like that.
Well, but there, for example, like the CIA has a major, I think, what was it, the Rand Corporation has a major tie-in with Sony. I mean, there are emails going back and forth between the Rand Corporation and Sony in terms of directly discussing what will be in movies. Are you aware of that?
No, I'm not.
Yeah. I mean, I would definitely say that people should look into that. Rand, Sony, Rand Corporation, Sony, and Google emails. There are emails going back and forth. And it's kind of, for me at least, it definitely indicates involvement. You know, of course, we have things out in the open, like you said, regarding like Ben Affleck's movie, when they freed the people from Iran, right? The hostage movie. What was that?
Right.
You know, so that was more out in the open. But I don't know. I think that it's interesting. It's definitely an interesting topic. I'm not so sure that things aren't sort of worked in. But let me ask you about archetypes. Do you think that in addition to sort of the general archetypes that we're talking about, good and evil, the hero and the villain, you know, some people say, and I want to get your take on this because it's, you know, it's okay no matter what your take is. Of course, you know, we like to be open to a lot of ideas. But some people say that the archetypes could be other interdimensional beings and sort of on a global level, they may be influencing different world leaders. Some people say there could be specific beings that could be archetypes. Do you see any of that coming through in symbolism in cinema? Let me give you an example. Let's say there was a movie that had a certain storyline that tied in with a Hindu goddess. And for example, the guy who wrote the book on string theory that physicists use today was an Indian gentleman. And physicists use this book for string theory today, and he said he got all the information in his dreams from a Hindu goddess, which is, it's another discussion, right? But do you see any tie-ins with specific sort of religious archetypes or you know, Greek gods or different things like that?
Well, sure. I mean, I don't know. I guess, you know, again, you know, when you're dealing with archetypal imagery, you know, and you know, you, these can be the embodiment of, you know, of different gods and goddesses. Sure. I mean, you know, it can be pagan. It can be Christian. It can be Judaic. I mean, Jesus is, you know, the sun. I mean, he's a solar avatar, you know, and, you know, even Moses is. So, you know, you can be dealing with archetypal imagery. Absolutely, surrounding you know, religious figures and religious you know, this is again what Campbell talked about. You know, was his hero's journey was by and large archetypal, and you know was containing imagery and themes that were universal. So you know, if you have it in you know, in mythology, certainly you're going to have it in religion. So yeah, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that.
Oh, okay, good. Why is this important? Like in terms of because I think it is. I think it's very important. But you're an expert. You've been studying this for so long. What do you think the biggest reason why this is important would be to the average person?
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, it's you know, why are they doing it? I guess, is that what you're asking me?
Well, why is it something that we should be aware of? You know, symbolism in cinema, like you said, it's a very powerful medium. But studying it for so long, why do you think it's important for people to be aware of? Because really, it's something I think that's amazing you're paying attention to, but and it's definitely become quite important to you. But what do you think the significance of it might be to the average person to so they're aware of it? Yeah.
Well, I mean, I can't say what the significance is to the average person.
What do you think it should be? What's your inclination as to why it's important for you?
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting because it really is. It's transforming. It's what the filmmakers are doing. It's modern mythology making is why it's important. It's really creating. It's using motion pictures to create modern day mythology. That's why it's so interesting to me. And you know, it's just so it's fascinating to see how these movies really can impact material culture, society, pop culture, and how they just become so integrated into our, you know, society. And it's powerful imagery, and that's what I found interesting. I compare it to sacred geometry or incorporating numbers into a building. You know, it's investing the building with a sense of divinity, and it's same thing with this esoteric imagery. It's transforming the film celluloid into modern day mythology. That's really the best way I can answer it.
Sure. And I agree. I think it's important. I think it's amazing what they're doing as well. So you're saying it's basically because they're doing it and the scale, and it's just very interesting to you that it's happening. Is that kind of why it's important to you?
Well, it's interesting because, like I said, it's modern day mythology making. I mean, I was born in 1971. I grew up on Star Wars. I mean, and that's just become so integrated into our society. And it's really just speaks to the power of these archetypes and this esoteric imagery in the films. And I find that very interesting is that these movies, they contain this mythology, this imagery. Not all of them do, but a lot of them do. And it's just fascinating to me the lengths these directors will go to place it in to really, you know, make their movie into something more than just a movie. It's really modern day mythology making. And I like it also because I think in some instances, it's a real challenge to these filmmakers. I think some of them really want you to pay attention and try to decode their films. And I think that's a fascinating challenge also.
I agree. So what do you think of the latest Star Wars since Disney has bought them? Do you think that there have been some changes and maybe not as much symbolism or more symbolism? What do you think about the changes that have occurred since Disney bought Star Wars?
Well, I haven't seen I haven't seen Rogue One yet. I saw Episode 7. I liked it. I thought it was very. It's somewhat of a remake of Episode 4, but I liked it enough. I thought it was good enough. I was entertained by it. I thought it was probably superior than Lucas's 1, 2, and 3, although I guess 2 wasn't too bad, and 3 is probably the best of the prequels. But I liked Episode 7. I thought The Force Awakens was good. I thought it was entertaining. I liked the direction they took it. And certainly the movie did have esoteric imagery in it and some esoteric themes. So I liked it. It's actually a movie that I'm planning on breaking down in my third book on cinema symbolism. I've got 1 and 2 out, and I'm actually outlining Cinema Symbolism 3, and I actually plan on decoding Episode 7 in that. Some very interesting themes going on.
That's beautiful. And when will Cinema Symbolism 3 be out, do you think?
For people? Oh, that's still probably a year or two away.
Okay. So people can look for that in the future for it. Yeah,
sure.
That's great. So what do you think some of the symbolism was in the previous episodes of Star Wars that you kind of analyzed? What were some highlights that you noticed?
Right. Well, episodes 4, 5, and 6 are the monomyth. This is the hero's journey. This is, you know, Luke Skywalker, you know, the sun figure doing battle with the evil dark overlord, Darth Vader, or the Emperor. I mean, clearly you have a comparative religion study going on here where Luke Skywalker is the solar avatar. You know, his name gives it away, Luke, meaning Lux, light. Skywalking, you know, what light walks across the sky, the sun. In ancient mythology, the premier sun god is Apollo. He has the lunar sister, Diana. So you have Princess Leia wearing the white robes of the moon. Again, comparatively, Apollo would be Horus. And, you know, he does battle with the dark evil lord Set. So you have the Sith. I thought that was a great play there. And, of course, you have Obi-Wan Kenobi, Yoda. This would be the god of magic, the Hermes Trismegistus archetype, think the hermit figure on the tarot card. This is a very popular archetype. Obi-Wan Kenobi, Yoda, think Morpheus in the Matrix movies, thinks, you know, Albus Dumbledore in Harry Potter, think Gandalf the Grey in Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. Same archetype, same figure. You have this entire interplay with light versus dark in Star Wars, Manichaeanism, you know, which we call Zoroastrianism, you know, the hero's journey where you clearly have, I won't get into it too much because, you know, it's a dense study. But, you know, when you're dealing with the monomyth, the hero's journey, you have these elements that repeat, one of them, which is like supernatural aid. So that would be when Luke gets the Skywalker. Clearly, you have the element of call to adventure, which is Luke being, you know, drawn off the boring desert planet to have this grand adventure against the dark evil overlord. Again, Harry Potter, think the same thing. The little boy being pulled from the staircase under the staircase to have this magical adventure against a dark evil lord. Think Neo Anderson in The Matrix, boring life, pulled, you know, from the doldrums of reality to have this grand adventure with this dark evil overlord, the machines. So it's the same theme over and over again. I like the imagery in Star Wars 4, 5, and 6. It's really a great movie. It's a great string of movies, series of movies to watch the Joseph Campbell monomyth in. When you're dealing with 1, 2, and 3, you do have imagery in that as well. You have the Anakin Skywalker story being a Christ allegory. You know, I mean, what's he born of the Virgin? He storms the temple. He's rejected by temple elders. Very, very Christ-like, for Anakin Skywalker. In fact, this is something that's really interesting, and this is something I talk about in the books, was this whole idea of using actors and actresses for occult purposes. And you actually find that in Episode 1 of Star Wars, where an actor or an actress may be cast for the cultural valences they bring to a certain movie. And this would be clearly the case of Pernella August, who played Anakin Skywalker's virgin mother in Phantom Menace, which was released in 1999. In that very same year, 1999, Pernella August also played, she played the Virgin Mary. She played the Virgin Mary in a made-for-TV show called Mary, the Mother of Jesus. So by casting her, Lucas is clearly trading on that Virgin Mary imagery, and it just reinforces the Anakin Skywalker as Christ imagery, again, which you'll find in the first three movies. And again, you'll have some esoteric imagery, some dualistic themes going on. I mean, I like in the second one, Attack of the Clones, where they're cloning, they're making the clones on the planet Kamino, which on the surface is the raging planet of water, symbolizing the female birthing process. But, you know, when you get inside the planet, it's dull. It's boring. It's completely dry. And, of course, the clones are all coming from a male. And this is why it's all boring on the inside. And even they even tell you, you know, he has great pain in the cloning process. This is because, of course, the woman has the great pain in the birthing process. But, of course, the Empire is evil because it's divested itself of the sacred feminine. There are no women anywhere to be found in the Empire. So there was some great imagery by Lucas there in even 4, 5, and 6, where you don't have any women in the Empire. It's great imagery. It's some great esoteric themes, much more going on beneath the surface than if you just first watch the movie, but you know, stuff to pay attention for, no doubt.
So do you think that in Star Wars and in these other movies that like the Matrix, are things quite similar? Are there themes? What do you think the reason is that these themes are going on, you know, sort of over and over? You've mentioned a couple times that these themes are sort of repeating themselves a lot, right? Why do you think that might be?
Well, because it's you know, if you read Young and Campbell, because it's just repeating mythology. And it's the same thing. You know, you'll find components of this almost in just about every movie, but some of them they really repeat in. So, you know, the hero's journey, the monomyth, you know, this is the Star Wars, this is the Luke Skywalker adventure. This is the adventure of Neo Anderson. This is the adventure of Frodo Baggins. This is the adventure of Harry Potter. If you read the book, you know, it's actually quite amazing how much of this material overlaps. And it's, again, it speaks to really the power of the collective unconscious and the power of the archetypes that, you know, this stuff repeats. And, you know, the authors of these books and the filmmakers may not even be consciously aware that they're doing it. But when you watch these films and you're aware of the monomyth and its elements, you see that pattern, you can really pick up on it and start seeing it, you know, much more readily. And even the Chronicle of Narnia by C.S. Lewis, it contains this same imagery as well. And it's quite uncanny, actually, in those movies and in those books. So, yeah, I mean, it just speaks to the power of the collective unconscious, and it speaks to the power of the archetypes.
Yeah, so you're saying that maybe they're not even aware, and it's sort of a subconscious thing. Well, you know, one thing that's interesting, let me ask you this. Every time, I've been noticing more and more, almost every movie now, you know, I turn on the movies, I turn on HBO or something, or Stars or Amazon Prime, and I see, like, you know, Brad Pitt had a movie, The Legends of the Fall, or there's maybe The Man Without a Face with Mel Gibson, Days of Thunder with Tom Cruise. I see some of these movies from the 90s, and then I see, like, everything coming out today. And somebody could say it's just all about the money, but there's always somebody dying, a lot of people dying, guns, explosions, constantly, you know, things blowing up, lots of violence. It seems more violent. And I'm only 36, so I'm not like 60 saying, you know, back in the day it wasn't as violent. But it just, there's so much violence. Do you think that's a collective unconscious thing? I have a feeling that it might be. I don't know what's going on with it, but I'm not so sure it's just all about the money or the collective unconscious, that maybe there's all this violence in the movies to bring it to our awareness, because there could be agendas to keep things chaotic in our society. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, you have violent movies, but you also have movies that aren't violent.
There's not as many, it seems. What do you think?
I just analyze the movies that I see esoteric imagery in. That's really what my books are about.
Yeah. So you don't notice more violence currently or anything like that. You have no comment on that, huh?
No, not really.
Okay. Well, I do. I think there's a lot of violence being brought forth, and I think it's on purpose in a way. And I don't know. Maybe it's unconscious. Maybe it's the subconscious or the collective subconscious. But I have a feeling, and then people could say it's because it's what people want to see. But I personally have a feeling there's an agenda to bring this violence forth. And if we didn't see it so much, we wouldn't be aware that, you know, we wouldn't even be aware that it exists. And it ties into a lot of things going on in the world. But it's okay, Rob, if you don't get into that. So let me ask you this. Rob, you're a Freemason. Do you think Freemasons are misunderstood?
No, not necessarily. I think there's a lot of bogus information out there about it. That I know for a fact, but I don't think it's, I think it can be misunderstood.
Sure.
Like I said, you know, there's tons of bad information out there. And one of my motivations of writing my first book was to kind of get into some of the stuff that was true and not true about it, because there was a Masonic conspiracy. Certainly there have been very powerful Freemasons, but by and large, it really doesn't exist anymore. You know, the Illuminati was real. I mean, I get into that in the Royal Arch of Enoch book. I don't know if I guess it can be misunderstood. Religions can be misunderstood. A lot of things can be misunderstood. But, you know, one of the motivations for writing my first book was to kind of, you know, maybe let people have a better understanding of it. But, yeah, I mean, there's some, you know, good information out there about it, and there's some bad information out there about it. You can get both sides of it.
Is good and what's not good in terms of what is out there, just so you can present?
There's tons. I mean, the bad is, oh, my goodness gracious. I mean, you'll hear, you know, Albert Pike invented the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry.
He was a Satanist, right? That guy?
Well, that's also nonsense.
Okay. He wasn't a. Yeah. Who is that? Just so some people might not even know who that is.
Well, Albert Pike was he was a Northerner. He fought during the Confederacy during the Civil War, and he is often credited, and I don't know why, as founding the Scottish Rite. I don't know why that is. The Scottish Rite was part of the high degree bodies of Freemasonry. The Scottish Rite was founded in May of 1801 by a man named Frederick Doucho. Albert Pike wasn't even born. He wasn't even born 8 years later. Why people, you know, still want to harp that Albert Pike had something to do with the founding of the Scottish Rite is beyond me.
Why would it be bad that he was involved?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Why would it be bad that he was involved? Like, why would people even care to begin with on that?
Oh, well, there's just so much bad information out there on him. He is often credited as being in the Illuminati.
Okay.
That's nonsense. That he wrote a letter to Giuseppe Manzini predicting three world wars. That's total BS. That's fiction. He is often credited with founding the Ku Klux Klan. That's also BS. There's just a lot of nonsense surrounding Albert Pike that is completely false. And this isn't me talking sequestered information. I mean, you know, the Scottish Rite was founded in 1801. This was like 7 or 8 years before Pike was even born. The Ku Klux Klan was founded by five ex-Confederate generals in Pulaski, Tennessee. I mean, Pike was never there. There's just, you know, the whole the World War III letter is made up. It was made up by a guy named William Guy Carr. It doesn't exist. There's just tons of bad information about Pike out there. And even in the American context, he's not even one of the most famous ritualists within Freemasonry. That would be a title that probably belongs to Thomas Smith Webb, that most people probably have never even heard of before. But when it comes to American Freemasonry, I mean, he is just critical to understanding how Masonry in America developed somewhat differently than in other places, such as like in England, on the continent of Europe. But again, you'll never hear his name mentioned at all.
Well, I have a friend who's a Freemason. He's a great guy. You know, he goes to meetings. I don't know what they do. We hear that the presidents are. You can clear some of this up. You know, we hear that the presidents are Freemasons. I voted for a couple, right? So, I mean, you know, meaning I'm not sure. But that's the thing. I'm not sure. A lot of people hear about secret societies. Of course, JFK gave a great speech that a big problem are secret societies. I don't know. Do you consider Masons or Freemasons to be, do you consider that to be a secret society? And why should people not be concerned with Freemasons?
Well, I would call it a society with secrets. It would be a better way for me to describe it. And it's pretty transparent. You can petition a Masonic lodge to join. You can read Masonic literature online. You can have access to Masonic books. You will readily find Masonic books written by Freemasons and non-Freemasons online on Amazon. So, you know, it's pretty transparent. It's influential. It's powerful. But I don't think I've been involved with it for 20 years, and I've never seen any satanic, devil-worshipping, reptilian shapeshifters in my 20 years. I suppose if it's out there, I guess it might be, but I've never I've seen it. With the presidents, I think it's been 14 United States presidents, I want to say, who have been Freemasons. The last one was Gerald R. Ford. We have had none since him.
Really? I've heard that Clinton was, and
false, totally false.
How do we know these things are false, by the way?
Because that's very easy. Because if it was true, the Masonic literature would promote it endlessly as a recruiting tool. So it's very easy to, anytime a celebrity or a politician becomes a Freemason, this is promoted all over the place. And believe me, I know, because I get all the Masonic literature. Whenever there's a famous politician or someone, an actor, or someone of note in Masonry, believe you me, you get word of it. The last president that we had who was a Freemason was Gerald R. Ford. Bill Clinton was in DeMolay, I believe. That's the Masonic Boy Scouts, but that's not the Freemasons. Bush 41 and 43 was in Skull and Bones. That's not the Freemasons. Ronald Reagan was an honorary Freemason, but Masons don't really consider that. Barack Obama had no membership, and neither does Donald Trump. Neither did Jimmy Carter. The last president that was a Freemason was Gerald R. Ford, and then before him, you got to go back to Harry Truman.
Got it. So I think some people are concerned because just like maybe our government, which we can send love to, forgive, and everything else, but, you know, we have the military, and they're pretty good people. People stand for them. They salute them no matter what, generally, games. And, well, now there's other things going on with other issues in the NFL, but... You know, so we have kind of the frontline people, right? And some people might be concerned with this in terms of Freemasonry. And then the idea is that perhaps there are compartmentalized sort of sections above all of this, that maybe there is a sort of, and this isn't a crazy idea. I mean, this, you know, the idea that there is something above the military, which would be our government, and then there are the military, the soldiers, which sort of do what they're told. I mean, that's actually quite out in the open. Why would Freemasonry be any different? I guess the idea is that there's a sort of maybe a front line or people that don't know what's going on, just sort of the average Freemason, and then maybe a sort of upper echelon that could be up to some shenanigans. What do you have to say about that?
That was the way it was. That happened. In the United States, the country was founded upon the principles of Freemasonry. The entire government is a Masonic organization. And what I mean by that is everything in the government from start to finish is basically based upon Freemasonry. The Constitution, the triple division of government, the architecture is all Freemasonic. And in the early days of the country, and this is specifically after Washington died in 1799, there was a secret cabal of Masons running the country behind the scenes. It was the Royal Arch Masons. This is what my first book is about. The guy who ran it, you may have in your travels have heard the term the Colombian Illuminati. This was the American version of the Illuminati. The guy who ran it was a person who has been erased from our history books called DeWitt Clinton. He was the former mayor of New York. He was the former governor of New York. And he was running the country from behind the scenes. So this happened. I don't dispute that. This all became unraveled in the mid-1820s with something called the William Morgan Affair, where this cabal was exposed. Masonry almost went out of business because of it. It survived because of the president of the time, who was Andrew Jackson, refused to give in to anti-Masonry. In fact, the first third political party in the country was called the anti-Masons. So, that should tell you what they were all about. So there was this secret cabal running the country, essentially, behind the scenes. Now, the guys who were doing this, such as DeWitt Clinton, some of the other names involved are Ezra Ames, the Livingston family, some of the other people. Ezra Ames was a biggie. These guys were – what they were doing was, when the country was still in its infancy, these guys were all working with the Federalists, John Adams and the like, but these guys were all Jeffersonian Republicans. And what they were trying to do is they were using the higher degree bodies of Freemasonry to unify the Federalists and the Jeffersonians. That was their motivation. They did not see this as evil, but this was all being done behind closed doors. There was no transparency of this. This was, you know, what you would call, quote unquote, an Illuminati-styled conspiracy. This was blown apart in the 1820s when it was exposed through this incident called the William Morgan Affair. And it literally destroyed Freemasonry in this country. Masonry went from being looked at as a patriotic order to very clandestine. Masonic Grand Lodges closed. I think the state of Vermont closed their doors. Teachers refused to teach children of Freemasonry. Many Masons were forced to renounce the craft, and it went into the Dark Ages, and it survived just because of Andrew Jackson, mainly in part. But one of the main side effects of this was two things. One is Masonry distanced itself from that point on, especially in America, of had any connection to the esoteric, to sort of being a modern-day mystery school. It went from being we just help widows and orphans. We're just a fraternal order who does charity work and does philanthropic deeds. That's it, period, end of story. The other side effect that it had was people persist in believing that it didn't go away. And they look at the architecture now and some of the symbolism, and they believe that today this is this evidence of this demonic, overarching grand Masonic theme, where it's really not. It's the guys who were creating the country were using the symbols, the tools, the lessons, the philosophies of Freemasonry to nation build. That's really what it's tantamount to. And it still survives. It still survives to this day. But, you know, like I said, the whole idea of Masons, of this still being around, it just doesn't exist anymore.
Well, it's very interesting. I think a lot of people say things may have been co-opted, right, over time. I mean, we have... From my understanding, the Illuminati came. There was something happening in France, and of course, it meant the Illuminated Ones, and maybe it wasn't so bad. And then maybe something happened, and it sort of got co-opted. We actually have the swastika, which came out of what, India, and it wasn't meant to be. My understanding is it wasn't an evil symbol out of India, and then. You know, we have what happened with that. You know, the Nazis got a hold of it. So it's interesting. A lot of these things seem to get sort of co-opted, like you're talking about. Maybe even some people say the United States right now with the military-industrial complex. One of those people was Eisenhower. He said that when he left. You know, that was his last speech, President Eisenhower saying, beware of the military-industrial complex. And some people say that's been, the U.S. in a way has been co-opted. And we had Project Paperclip, and we had... Of course, the 20,000 or however many thousand former Nazi scientists coming in. But maybe they were good guys. I don't know. But there's a lot of questions about these things, and people do have misconceptions. So let me ask you this. What is good about the Freemasons? Like, yeah, because I agree. If you're just like the Catholic Church, I was raised Catholic. A lot of nonsense happened with the Catholic Church actually quite recently. So you're saying things were in the 1920s, the Freemasons sort of, there was a big change and it sort of became about charity work. But a lot of great people, I think, are Catholics now. But there is still an element. We just had a guy on from Rome. He's been on, you know, written so many books about the nonsense going on now, even today. He reports on it. There was a big story that became mainstream news about a gay orgy. I mean, you know, and to me, I don't know that that matters, but for the Catholic Church, it was a big scandal this summer. And so there is stuff going on all the time with people, everybody. It's just to what degree the nonsense is occurring. But that being said, you're saying that the Freemasons now have changed. What is good about the Freemasons? What should people know about it in terms of what you stand for?
Right. Well, I think it was always positive. But I guess positive could be perceived as a certain point of view.
You're right.
But I believe it's always been positive, a positive force in the world. I mean, for me, my goodness, it definitely helped me understand who I was. I understood the rituals. I understood, you know, that I was going in, and I believe that I came out a better person for it. My books would not exist, but for my membership in Freemasonry. So I view the entire experience as positive. I have talked to people who have started it and dropped out. It wasn't for them. I mean, I can only speak for myself, but I've had nothing but a positive experience with it. I'm proud of my membership. And
what should people know? Why is it good? Because people, I think, are just skeptical of anything that could be. You're right. People lump things together, as you've mentioned, you know. So, you know, anything that's sort of secret in any way, people might think is sort of a dark force or a secret.
Well, no, go ahead. No.
Well, yeah, like
right.
a secret controlling.
Just because something's secret doesn't mean it's bad.
You're right. But people, you know what? People get lied to a lot. Would you agree?
people get lied to a lot.
We're $20 trillion in debt. I mean, there's a lot of nonsense going on. So people, I think, and all of us to some degree.
I think people are gullible, and they want easy solutions for their lives, and they're gullible.
It could be true.
And they want a scapegoat to when something goes wrong in their lives. They want a scapegoat rather than taking responsibility.
You're right about this, but they're also getting lied to a lot.
And they're lying to themselves a lot also.
That could be true. But we have had institutions which lie to people. I mean, we've enslaved people. Would you agree we've enslaved people?
People lie to people every day.
That's right. So anything secret, I think, you know, people lump things together. Maybe it's unjust. So aside from you being proud of being in the Freemasons, or being a Freemason, I think that's good. And you're right. The definition of positive and negative is very interesting because, you know, if there wasn't any winter, would we appreciate summer? I mean, that's sort of... Somebody could debate that all day. What is positive and negative? But let me ask you this. What is good in terms of what society should view with the Freemasons? What's good about it for people?
I believe that it promotes democracy. It promotes egalitarianism. It promotes equality. It teaches you how to walk upright. It teaches you moral principles. It teaches you how to guide your life in a just way. It does philanthropic work. And for me, it was a very positive experience, and I wouldn't trade it in for anything. And my three books would not exist but for my Masonic membership. I can only speak for myself.
Sure.
And, you know, if someone joins it and doesn't like it, there's nothing I can do about that.
I understand.
But for me, I found its teachings to be very positive. I found its morality to be very positive, and it certainly taught me to be a better person.
If it is so good, and I think it could be, I don't know. I mean, I'm just asking questions, right? But why are there any secrets? I mean, what's the not what the secrets are, but what are the purpose of what's the purpose of the secrecy at all? Because you're right, some things that are secret could possibly not be quote unquote bad. But why are there secrets, you think?
Well, the secret to it is in each individual Mason. That's really the secret. And each individual Mason will take out of Freemasonry what they put into it. And the secret of Masonry is in each individual Mason's heart. That's really the answer to it. So what I got out of it, someone else may get something else out of it. That's the real secret of it. The rituals in themselves, just as a sort of, you know, to kind of get into what I think you're more asking me about. The rituals definitely encode allegorical meaning that is deeper than what is explained to you in the lodge. But what this does is, if the Mason is interested in this, as I was, and not all are, it puts you on a path to try to learn and unravel what these rituals are telling you. And I believe that in doing that, if you begin to unravel them, you will find some hidden truths in there and some things that are worth investigating. And this was, again, part of my motivation for writing the first book I wrote, which was The Royal Arch of Enoch. So, you know, with me, the journey that it put me on was it opened this door to, for me, this is just me personally speaking,
sure,
was to look at things symbolically. symbolically and to interpret things symbolically and not literally. And it was through that that I was able to produce my three books. So that was what I got out of it. Now, another Freemason may come on and say something completely different.
I see.
But I can only give you my perspective of it.
So there's some freedom there for you to be an individual and to kind of get out of it what's within you, right?
I think that's fair to say.
Okay, because you're saying, yeah, other people could have other experiences completely. So that's good to know. I don't think people know enough about all of this, so I just appreciate you opening up and just kind of sharing your experience, because that's the whole idea of our network. But I do think that, people have a lot of concerns about everything. And you're right. There are people that they lie to themselves. We could get into discussions all day about that. But some people, I think, rightly assume there are certain hidden hands working at work in the world. I don't think that's a crazy thing to say. Whether it's the Freemasons or not, you know, people don't really know. And you're saying that, no, it's become an organization that is mainly focused on charity and sort of personal growth. Is that right?
That's part of it, sure.
Okay. And the other part would be?
Well, I mean, do we have 24 hours to get into this? I mean, you know, we could talk about this. This is a conversation that has no beginning or has no ending. Mm. You know, it can be whatever you want it to be. For me, it taught me to just decode the world symbolically. If a person joins it and doesn't like it, guess what? They don't like it. What do you want me to do about it? If a person believes there are hidden hands all working all over the place against them and everything's a conspiracy, what the hell am I supposed to do about it? If a person wants to believe in Santa Claus and leprechauns, let them. What can I do about it? I mean, I joined Masonry because I come from a long line of Maryland Masons. And, you know, it was something that was very important to me. I went into it openly. I went into it willingly. I understood the morality that was teaching me. I understood what it was going for. I understood that it was divine spark ignition, that it was sort of what I would call a Gnostic reawakening. That once you go through the rituals, you can affect positive change. But for me, it taught me to view things symbolically, not necessarily literally. That's what Robert W. Sullivan IV mainly got out of it.
Well, that's good. So that's what matters. That's the bottom line, because I think there could be good in everything, personally. So I like that. That's amazing. I mean, you don't need me to like that, but I don't know. I don't know that it has to be. I mean, there could be some hidden hands, but there could be good in the Masons. So I don't think it has to be all one way or the other, personally. But
everything casts a shadow.
Yeah, and even you said yourself, there were elements of it at some point where maybe it wasn't, you said, negative, but there was a cabal within the Masons, right?
Well, right. Back in the day, when Washington died, really was right. When you had this sort of royal arch, high degree cabal sort of pulling the strings behind the curtain.
In the church, I mean, there's been things in the church. And I mean, you know, it's not, yeah, we all have this within us where, you know, there's a bit of, there could be things going on, but you're right. People get a little jumpy because it has happened before in the past. So I think we have to understand that maybe as well, right?
Well, I think for me, one of the reasons for writing my book, well, at least the first one, was there was almost this two bodies of thought going on. There was the Freemasons control everything, and there's this dark, evil conspiracy going on, which is, of course, nonsense. And then there was this other body of thought that said, oh, there's no Masonic influence at all. There's none of that. And all that's conspiracy theory. That's also not true.
Right.
You know, so when you get into when Masonry, I mean, you are clearly, when you're dealing with the cultivation of the United States, the people founding this country knew what they didn't want. They didn't want a monarchy and they didn't want a Vatican-styled organization.
Sure.
So what they did was they turned to the teachings of Freemasonry and they literally crafted a nation around it. In fact, in the Royal Arch of Enoch book, I have a chapter called The United States of Freemasonry. I present that it's the world's first and really only Masonic republic. That to me is completely irrefutable. I don't look at this as a negative. I guess that's
sure.
The point I'm trying
well,
to make.
Well, it's all a progression, maybe. It's a progression. But I think all sides of things are interesting. And, it seems to be a progression. And we're all a part of it, whether we're in the Freemasons or not. Or, you know, we're all a part of it one way or another. So I think in a way, if somebody decides it's positive, it's positive. If somebody decides it's not, it's not. That's what Einstein asked. He said, is the universe a friendly place? And I think he didn't give the answer on purpose. And I, you know, I read that somewhere. I thought it was quite interesting. So we get to decide maybe. So, and that's what I'm getting from you, Rob. So, Rob, what are the names of your books and where can people get them?
I'm sorry, you broke up there. I didn't hear that.
Oh, sure, sorry. What are the names of your books and where can people get them, Rob?
Right, sure. I have three books out currently. I have a fourth book coming out in a couple months. But the three books that are out right now are titled The Royal Arch of Enoch, The Impact of Masonic Ritual, Philosophy, and Symbolism. Then there's Cinema Symbolism, A Guide to Esoteric Imagery in Popular Movies. And then there's Cinema Symbolism 2, More Esoteric Imagery in Popular Movies. Ta-da. These books are readily available on all main online retailers. You can get them on Amazon. You can get them on Barnes & Noble. You can get them on Nook. The Kindle, the Nook. It's on Books A Million. The Royal Arch book and Cinema Symbolism have been recently republished as second editions. These have been somewhat revised by me, so you're going to want to get those copies. And again, they're available on all the main online retailers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. And you can get the ebooks as well, the Kindle, the Nook. I think they're on places like Ebook Mall, Kobo. They're all readily available. If you go to those sites and just type in the name of the book, believe me, it'll come up.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Rob. You're helping a lot of people to understand other perspectives and to see symbolism, to see sort of greater meanings. And I think that's a good thing. I think that's a really amazing thing personally. And I think people should pick up your books. And, you know, we help people to, again, find your own truth. Find your own truth. That's what we want to help you to do, and that's what Rob has done. I recommend you pick up his books. Our website is www.believe.love. Find us on YouTube at youtube.com/believeloves you and share this interview with your friends, because this is something that people, they don't want to talk about. They do. People, we just make assumptions, and it's good to just hear perspectives. You know, it's good to hear perspectives. We don't have to agree. You don't have to agree with me 100% or Rob or anybody else, but you find your own truth when you at least consider perspectives and you're willing to hear it. So I appreciate so much Rob coming on today. And thank you for joining us on Believe. I'm Nicholas Upchurch. Have a great day or night wherever you may be.